Congress will keep the lights on for the government.
And they've got plans for your light bulbs as well.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Happy Friday. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this December 16th.
Coming up, government shutdown averted in Washington.
Why retirement in America is likely to be very different even after the economic recovery.
And dogs go vegan. Well, at least they might if Ellen DeGeneres has her way.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Lawmakers in Washington are on track to pass a $1 trillion spending bill this afternoon to avoid a government shutdown at midnight tonight. Now, that's likely to clear the way for a short-term extension of the payroll tax cut.
For more on all this, let's bring in Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. He's with us from New York, as he is every Friday. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
So with this big threat that was looming of another government shutdown, I think this is the 487th government shutdown threat this year, did economists like you pay attention, or did you just sort of look at it and say, they'll figure it out?
We looked at it and said they'll figure it out. And you know, even though that they had these sort of intractable things they were not going to give up on, they did. They blinked. And I think the bottom line is they realized the voters aren't even going to bother to sort out whose fault it is. If they shut down the government, they're all going to suffer for it.
And when it comes to the payroll tax cut, it looks like we may well get a couple of month extension of the payroll tax cut. This is a big controversial issue. But it does look like what will end up happening is instead of taxing millionaires or whatever, they're just going to probably add to the deficit, right?
Yeah, they probably are. And while it is disappointing, as an economist, I hate to say it, but it's probably the right thing to do. The economy is still super weak. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to tackle the deficit now. And besides, we still have these historically very, very low interest rates.
Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Let's talk now about what all this means for the economy. A lot of moving parts going on there. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large with CBS Money Watch, and she's with us from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Hey, Jill.
Good morning.
Now, the fact that this government shutdown threat didn't last very long, do you think that's going to boost market confidence?
I wouldn't go crazy. It's more of a relief than a full-fledged confidence booster. I guess now economists and investors have a reprieve. They can enjoy the holidays, and then they can just get back to what they love to fret over, Europe.
There you go. Yeah, but we have a lot of stuff here domestically that needs wrapping up by year's end. Payroll tax cuts, I mentioned, unemployment benefit extension. Is that stuff going to get done, do you think?
I think it is. Lawmakers are, as you said, preparing this plan B where they, if they don't reach the long-term agreement in the coming days, they will go for this two-month extension.
Yeah.
That costs $40 billion over 10 years. It's a lot easier to find $40 billion than the full extension, which is $200 billion. But, you know, beyond the payroll tax, the extension of unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed, there have been very few details about how to pay for that or how to pay for a scheduled cut in Medicare payments to doctors. You know, Congress never disappoints. They love to go right to the mat, to the bitter end, and drag us down there with them.
Jill Schlesinger with CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
Well, in the bill Congress is likely to pass today is a little unrelated provision, Steve, involving light bulbs.
Interesting.
Remember the government had planned to phase out certain kinds of bulbs in
January?
Incandescent
bulbs, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, as Scott Tong reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that date is being pushed back.
The fight is over the cheapest, least efficient light bulbs. A law passed 4 years ago and signed by President Bush phases them out starting in January. Jim Presswood at the Natural Resources Defense Council says more efficient incandescents will still be for sale. They cost a bit more, but ultimately save you money by cutting your power bill.
New efficient incandescent bulbs are about 30% more efficient than the old incandescent bulbs, which have essentially been unchanged since Thomas Edison made some innovations to them about 120 years ago, and most of the energy of these incandescent bulbs is wasted as heat.
Republican leaders have a philosophical beef with this. It's a matter of consumer choice. Today's spending bill undercuts enforcement. It deprives the government of money to bust the makers and importers of less efficient bulbs. at least for 9 months, so you may see them on the shelves. Confused? Industry is not a fan of this back and forth either. Sylvania, Philips, and GE all supported the new standards, and they retooled their factories. Now the goalposts are moving again. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There are a lot of things being cut in the spending bill to get the plan approved, at least in the short term, like federal disaster assistance, which is important to places such as Alabama. It's important to a lot of places, obviously. Yeah. Alabama, though, was pummeled by tornadoes 8 months ago. And it's also that state, Jeremy, that passed one of the most stringent immigration laws in the country. And we're going to talk about those topics and more. In our Midday Extra today, Robert Bentley joins us. He's the governor of Alabama, a Republican, and we welcome him to the program. Governor, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Steve.
I want to start with today's big news that Congress, of course, has agreed to this compromise budget plan to keep the government open. And I know one of the areas that's being cut is disaster relief. And that's something that Alabama, of course, is no stranger to because of the horrible tornadoes that happened on April 27th of this year, which killed more than 240 people in the state. Now, you're a big supporter, of course, of balancing budgets. Were those cuts, do you think, necessary?
Well, I think we don't know when disasters will occur. And, we do need to keep a reserve available for any type of natural disaster. So I think that's very important, not just for Alabama, but I think it's important for the entire United States because no one knows when a disaster will hit. It may be an earthquake in California. You never know. So we need to keep a reserve there, I think, for everyone. I think that's very important.
How's the recovery effort going over there?
The recovery effort has been outstanding, and we're 6 months ahead of any natural disaster that's ever hit the United States, and we've had unprecedented cooperation from the locals all the way up through our state and also through our federal government. I'm very appreciative of FEMA. For what they did, they came in after I told them that I was in charge of the disaster, and because the governor should always be in charge. But they were very supportive. They did an outstanding job, and I'm very appreciative for what they did.
What about the idea that FEMA should cut? There should be cuts as much as the money that the government should give to FEMA.
Well, I think that I just think we need to adequately fund FEMA because, as I said, we never know when a natural disaster will hit us. No state knows that. So I think that we need to just at least have a minimum amount that will take care of any natural disaster that hits any state.
I want to turn now to the immigration law, which is, of course, in the headlines in a lot of areas of the country. And it requires in Alabama for police to detain people they suspect of being there illegally. Why support such an immigration law in the first place? How is illegal immigration affecting Alabama?
Well, we've had a tremendous increase in Alabama in the number of illegal aliens that we know of. Now, they say we're undocumented, and they are undocumented, so there are a lot that we don't even know about. But we do know that it does cause on every state a tremendous strain on the social systems, hospitals, schools. And it's the federal law that you're not supposed to live and work in this country if you're not legal, or if you don't have some legal way of getting here as a visa. And we're not opposed to that. I mean, we're very much in favor of legal immigration into this country, and we're very much in favor of workers that come in under the legal system, and that's the way we want it to occur.
What about people who claim, Governor, the law has caused an exodus of workers and no one there to fill the jobs that those workers did? The claims by farmers that crops are dying because they can't be harvested or construction help is going away?
Well, it's hard to measure undocumented workers because they're not documented. So we really don't know how many are leaving because they are undocumented and they're under the radar, so we really don't know that. And we also know that in places like North Alabama, where the poultry industry is very strong, we know that we've had job fairs in those areas. There have been some workers that have left, but we have hired Alabamians to do those jobs, and the poultry industry has gone on without a hitch, and so. You know, there are some problems with some people, some who have relied on illegal workers over the last few years, and we know that that's going to be a problem, but we're going to work through that. We have set up in our Department of Industrial Relations for the first time ever a way to hire part-time workers, and we had people go online and register who wanted to do agricultural work, and we have been matching the farmers with the workers, and so we're going to try to solve that problem, and we're going to work through that and help farmers get through that.
I know there have been some pretty high-profile detentions because of the law, too. The German Mercedes executive, of course, a Japanese Honda worker near that company's plant in Lincoln. Do those incidents, do you think, expose flaws in the law?
Probably it did, and you know, one of the things that I had to do is governor. I mean, I execute the law, so my Department of Homeland Security is in charge of the law enforcement part, and so we see the problems that may be associated with it. Any complicated bill that's passed, I was in the legislature for 8 years, and I know that any complicated law that's passed, as it's implemented, there may be some unintended consequences, but. And we're going to work through those, and we're going to clarify those, we're going to simplify those, and we're going to make this law more effective. Now, having said that, two things are not going to happen. We're not going to repeal this law, and the second thing we're not going to do is, the second thing that's important to remember is if you're going to work in Alabama or live in Alabama, you have to be legal. And if you're going to hire workers, you have to hire legal workers. And that's not going to change. And this law is not going to be repealed, and that part of the law will not change. But the other parts, to make it simpler, to make it so that we can clarify it, help the law enforcement understand how to carry out this law, making sure that no one is profiled, making sure that we respect everyone's human right. Now, they're civil rights if they're a citizen. Human rights are important also. So we're going to do that. We're going to make sure that we do things right.
How do you think this makes Alabama look outside of Alabama? Because I know a lot of people support this law within the state. Do you think it hurts Alabama's business image?
Well, you know, I hear that, and but I can tell you every day I talk with international companies. We already have on the books some announcements over the next 2 or 3 weeks for some large international companies that will be locating in Alabama, and I continue to be in contact with them on a regular basis to reassure them, if they need reassurance, that Alabama is open for business and we're open for international business, and we're a model state for that, starting with Mercedes in 1993, and we have a lot of German companies, we have a lot of Korean companies, Chinese companies are now coming to Alabama, and so I don't see it as a problem right now, but we want to make sure that it does not become a problem, and that's why I, as governor, I've talked about simplifying this bill, clarifying it, to make it look less anti-immigrant, especially legal immigrant.
Governor Robert Bentley of Alabama, sir, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And you have a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Governor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, amid all the wrangling over the spending bill and the payroll tax cut, there was this strangely bipartisan proposal to reform Medicare. It came yesterday from Republican Congressman Paul Ryan and Democratic Senator Ron Wyden. The thing is, though, Steve, right now doesn't really seem like the best time to launch a major legislative proposal on such a controversial issue.
Or is it?
So why did they do it? Here's our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale.
The Wyden-Ryan proposal would offer seniors the option of getting their medical services from the government or from private insurance plans. But the lawmakers aren't introducing any legislation. Congressional scholar Thomas Mann at the Brookings Institution says the two sponsors are looking beyond legislative gridlock.
The only conceivable reason is to shape the way in which Medicare is a part of the 2012 election campaign.
So why put a proposal on the table so early? The Urban Institute's Judy Fader says Representative Ryan wants to repair the political shellacking his earlier proposal to privatize Medicare received.
He is proposing something kinder and gentler than what he's had on the table in order to win over the millions of people he's scared with his original proposal.
Some political strategy experts say the Medicare reformers could have picked a better week to make a splash with their idea. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. There was a big vote in Italy today, and it was seen as a confidence vote for the Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti's new government.
This, of course, was the passage of a $43 billion package of cuts and reforms that would help restore confidence in Italy's economy. The BBC's Alan Johnston is in Rome, and he has more on that story for us. Hey, Alan.
Hi, hello.
Is this new plan actually going to get Italy's debt problem under control, do you think?
Well, I guess if Mario Monti, the new prime minister, was here, he would tell you that it's a start, at least. There's a lot more restructuring that needs to go on, but he would say it's a beginning. Some, though, would argue that he started too tamely. Others would say that he needs to go more quickly, more rapidly. Still others, on the left of the political spectrum especially, have argued that this package of austerity measures is too hard on the poorest and the oldest Italians.
This all seems to be not just a test for Italy, but for the whole Eurozone pact, right?
Well, certainly Italy is on the front line of this really major Eurozone crisis. Italy is in as much danger as any country, perhaps, of being crushed by its weight of debt. And the money markets have looked at Italy and worried very much about its financial situation. And they have very much wanted to see the kind of austerity measures that we are beginning to see being introduced by this new government.
The BBC's Alan Johnston reporting from Rome. Alan, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Cheers, then.
The ratings agency Fitch has slashed the credit scores of some of the world's biggest banks, among them Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Barclays, and Deutsche Bank. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The big banks face a sea of troubles. The Eurozone debt crisis is just part of the problem. That's made it difficult for banks to borrow and therefore to lend in Europe. Then there's the slowing global economy. That means less activity and lower revenues for the banks. And piling on the agony, the regulators have tightened banking rules, making the business less profitable. Peter Thal Larsen of the financial website Breaking Views.
All those factors are kind of weighing on the big banks. That pushes up the cost of credit for banks and obviously also makes them more risky as far as the credit rating agencies are concerned.
But the backlash against the credit rating agencies continues to grow. They stand accused of being part of the problem of worsening the downturn with their downgrades. A prominent Swiss economist says companies and countries should be able to sue the agencies for damages. When countries and companies suffer a cut in their credit rating, they can lose billions of dollars. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, back here at home, the government said this morning consumer prices stayed flat last month. Economists watch the Consumer Price Index, the CPI as it's called, for signs of inflation. So far this year, though, things have stayed pretty steady, though there have been a couple of big exceptions, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
The Core Consumer Price Index tracks the cost of Kindle readers, Santa sweaters, your plane ticket home for the holidays, pretty much everything you buy, except gas and food. They're considered too volatile to count. Food prices have jumped about 5% this year. Oil prices are up more than 30% since October.
That's the biggest joke with these inflation numbers because it excludes food and energy.
Oil analyst Stephen Shork says high gas prices really affect the economy.
We know consumers really begin to pull back on driving and alter their behavior.
And consumers' attitudes. Chris Christopher is an economist with IHS Global Insight.
When gas prices go up, or when food prices go up, people get very upset.
And when shoppers are upset, they don't spend. Christopher says it's very important for the economy that food and gas prices ease in 2012.
When consumers lighten up a bit, maybe businesses will start hiring more. And when businesses start hiring more, then consumers will start spending more.
And Christopher says that could be the start to a real economic recovery. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Now to a new survey of Facebook users in the UK, Steve, that finds that they were under the influence of alcohol in 76% of their photos.
Are you serious?
That's right. And more than half of those surveyed by MyMemory.com said they wouldn't want their coworkers to see the pictures. I think something like 8% say that they would face serious trouble if their bosses saw the pictures.
Wow.
But the funny thing is that two-thirds of them say they've been posting embarrassing pictures of their friends.
They've been doing it themselves to their friends. Wow, that's really nice.
At least 10 million homeowners in the U.S. are still underwater on their mortgages, meaning they owe more than the house is worth. That's the latest figure from RealtyTrack. Now, those underwater homes are keeping millions of Americans from moving, even if they can get work in another city. And our economics correspondent Chris Farrell says retirees are being impacted as well. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Chris, I know that the recession has had a big impact on migration patterns, where people move for jobs and whether they can move at all because of the weak housing market. First of all, what's been happening with retirees on that front?
Well, the retirees are no different than everyone else. They're aging in place. There's not a big migration from the snow belt to the sun belt anymore. But here's the thing, Jeremy. I know it sounds crazy, but when the economy recovers, and yes, the economy will recover someday, and when the housing market improves, retirees are still not going to move to the Sun Belt the way they used to, say, in the 60s and the 70s.
Why not, Chris? I mean, has Arizona lost its sunny sparkle that brings them down there, or Florida?
No, the sun still comes up. It's still nice and warm. Everyone now realizes that they need to work well into the traditional retirement years, you know, work longer, earn an income, delay taking Social Security. Well, scholarly research shows that about 50% of our jobs come from our networks, informal networks, family, friends, colleagues, former bosses. And so if you move from the snow belt to the sun belt, or you move hundreds of miles away, you're leaving your network behind, and it's that much harder to get a job.
Well, if more and more people are going to stay in the snow belt, as you say, does that mean that we need to start thinking differently about how we plan for retirement?
Oh, we really do. I mean, so much of the discussion about retirement is stocks and bonds and asset allocation. Look, if we're going to be working longer into retirement, here are the investments that really matter: skill, education, health. And finally, and most importantly, your network. So the biggest investment that people can be making is nurturing their network where they are today and age in place and continue to work longer.
Although it'll be a little bit colder, I guess. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Today's the day thousands of stores are waiving shipping fees. It's Free Shipping Friday, Jeremy. Did you know that? Happy Free Shipping
Friday.
There
you go. Yeah. Time to order some more stuff.
I've got a card for you. It's an effort to get you to browse, of course, and to spend money at those shops online. Retail sales on the web this holiday season are up 15%, so maybe it's been working over last year. And as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, retailers are doing whatever they can to bring the mall to you.
Ben Domenech is watching the History Channel at his house in Mount Vernon, Virginia.
Larry the Cable Guy on History.
He's also shopping.
Get her done!
And there's a Cable Guy Get Her Done shirt for $24.95. And I Love This Country t-shirt in olive for $24.95.
Domenech passed on the t-shirts, but he could have bought them through his Verizon Fios TV with his remote. Sucharita Mulperu is with Forrester Research. She says mobile shopping is expected to bring in $6 billion this year. Still, just a slice of e-commerce, but a growing one.
People have more devices. They want to have the convenience, and it's easy.
You've probably seen those square black and white codes. They're called QR codes popping up everywhere. They allow smartphone users to buy products with a swipe. In November, Sears and Kmart rolled out shopping walls with QR codes in airports and movie theaters so people could buy toys on their way to a plane or to the popcorn counter. Benjamin Kennedy is with the ad agency Integer Group.
Mobile has in effect made traditional media, which was very passive, an interactive experience that can prompt a sale, you know, via a mobile device.
But Kennedy says the everywhere mall still has a long way to go. Credit card info is a pain to enter on your phone. Connection speeds can be slow. And just to use a QR code, sometimes you have to download an app.
Which really, really puts that consumer off and makes it harder for that marketer to engage them at a future date.
All of that may have something to do with the fact that Sears told me in an email the company is phasing out its shopping walls well before the end of the holiday season. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And while we're on the subject of shopping and malls and consumers, you should note that today on Marketplace with Kai Rizdahl, it's going to be at a retail special show.
Oh, yeah.
And Kai is going to be broadcasting from a busy outlet mall.
And finally this morning, talk show host Ellen DeGeneres, Jeremy, and her wife, Portia de Rossi, are reportedly developing a vegan pet food line.
Hmm.
Yes. Animal advocates say dogs, however, are better able than cats to adapt to a completely meat-free diet.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if you know this or not, but apparently dogs can weather that storm. But apparently cats need the additional protein and the iron, I guess, that comes with meat.
Hmm.
So even advocacy groups for cats say you got to add some meat. Anyway, there is this vegan pet food line that's going to be starting off with Ellen and Portia. We know that this canine won't be down with the new veggie fare, though.
Yummy, crunchy, bacon, bacon, bacon! There's
a bacon! Who wants a bacon
string? Me! I get it myself, but I don't have thumbs!
He doesn't have thumbs, Jeremy. He doesn't. How's he going to get the bacon without the thumbs? I tell you, though, these days, of course, could be like maybe a carrot stick or something like that, right? It's
new.
A carrot! No,
that's
you
right.
Can't do that.
We'll see. Bugs Bunny.
It's celery!
Bugs Bunny will be the new, spokesman. In Los Angeles,
man.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiantakis. Oh, the week is over. Enjoy your weekend.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.